Today, some quotations and thoughts from one of the most important books of the 20th century.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
I know you think I'm exaggerating. I'm not. This is on almost every list of the most significant works of the 20th century. Sometimes in the top 10, sometimes simply in the top 50. If it's all books written in the 20th century, sometimes it takes 100 books to get there, but it's always on the list. It's called The Origins of Totalitarianism, written in 1951, or at least first put out, published in 1951. The edition that I'm going to be using today, as we refer to it, is actually from the early 1970s, and it's written by an author I've mentioned before, a brilliant thinker, one of the smartest people in the 20th century, Hannah Arendt, everything I've read from her is well worth reading. I think we referred in previous episodes to Eichmann in Jerusalem, a work that she did as a series of magazine articles that finally became its own work, sort of analyzing what happened in the after Nuremberg, after World War II, after the Holocaust, when Adolf Eichmann went back to Jerusalem. Anyway, this book is a much more significant tome on a political science, sort of political science, sort of sociological perspective on how the Nazi fascist movement and also the Marxist communist movement in the Soviet Union took place. So the Nazi fascists in Germany, the rise of totalitarianism being Hitler, and then the communist rise in the Soviet Union, obviously under Stalin. And so during that time, she encountered a lot of these things herself, having grown up in Europe, having fled Germany to Paris, having lived in Paris through the 7 years while the Reich was rising in Germany and in power, having actually been kept in a camp for expats that were from Germany in France in fear of the Nazis who were coming. She actually ended up being in a prison camp briefly and held until she finally escaped and was able to make it to America ultimately. And she was a brilliant scholar here for the time that she was here, and well-respected because of her ability, her perspective, that she brought in full knowledge of what had transpired in Europe and in other parts, in other regions around Europe, during especially the rise toward World War II, the interwar years also between World War I and II and into World War II. And she's just a brilliant historian and political scientist. She's fantastic. So I love reading everything I've read from her. So the other book that I read from her recently, the other one that I read from her recently was on revolutions, the comparison between the American and French Revolution, which I mentioned in another episode as well. Another brilliant book. This one, The Rise or The Origins of Totalitarianism, has so many quotations in it that forced me to pause as I was. And I have the Kindle version, and then I also have the Audible version. And, you know, sometimes, I like technology, and I like listening to the books while I'm writing. And sometimes it's really handy because if you have both Kindle and Audible, you can listen back and forth. It'll pick up where you are on the page as you're reading visually, but also audibly. So it's nice to be able to go back and forth. There were a lot of times that I would go back and look at a quotation again and make sure I heard it the way that it's actually written, and just made a note for myself and then thought to myself eventually, you know, I should just do one episode, not expanding or expounding on it thoroughly, but just sharing some of these quotations for the reason that we need to learn from history. And I'm not even going to prescribe the lesson. I mean, to a certain extent, I'll bring up a few examples along those lines at the beginning. But really, most of this, I just have the quotation that I'd like for you to read and think about, and then maybe a category within which we ought to be saying to ourselves, wow, I should pay attention if I see that happening. If I see that that's what's transpiring, I should at least be aware of where it led in the past and make sure that that's not where it leads now, or that I don't participate in what's going on with that right now. So here, we'll start and we're starting late in the book. This book has three major sections. I'm taking a little portion from the middle section, but most of it from the last section of the book, which is where I am now, by the way, so coincidentally. Anyway, the first section I'm going to take from is a chapter entitled The Decline of the Nation State and the End of the Rights of Man. And this one is pertinent to a lot of things that are going on right now, so it'll be easy for me to... I don't want to become too polemical about it or anything like that, but it'll be easy for me to moralize for a minute and for you to be able to say, oh, yeah, well, I can see that, and I can see why you would draw that conclusion. The other conclusions I'll leave more open-ended most of the time. So here's the first part. The decline of the nation state and the end of the rights of man. Here's the statement. No paradox, and I'm quoting from Hannah Arendt now, no paradox of contemporary politics is filled with a more poignant irony than the discrepancy between the efforts of well-meaning idealists who stubbornly insist on regarding as inalienable those human rights which are enjoyed only by the citizens of the most prosperous and civilized countries, and the situation of the rightless themselves. Their situation has deteriorated just as stubbornly. Until the internment camp, prior to the Second World War, the exception rather than the rule for the stateless, has become the routine solution for the problem of domicile of the displaced persons. In fact, she goes on to talk about that categorizing of displaced persons and stateless individuals that I'll read you more of in just a moment. But just this opening paragraph, this opening line or few lines that I read to you just now, reveal to you what's going on here, that she's immediately addressing this inherent tension, the inherent problem in understanding the relationship between human rights, something that you own because you're a human being, and legal rights, and the things that you have because you are the citizen of a country. And so in our Declaration of Independence, which is what she's obliquely referring to here, the statement is, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator. So this is all men. This is human rights that we're describing. They're endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. So it's not possible for those rights to be removed from a person because they just go with the person. It's what it means to be a person, that you have these, right? That's the idea in the Declaration of Independence. And then the statement that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But then even the authors of the Declaration of Independence, and obviously most significantly Thomas Jefferson, are making this statement that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. So we say, well, the rights are unalienable, and yet we acknowledge immediately that we have to secure the rights. Securing them means making them so they don't become alienated from you. That doesn't mean it's wrong. I'm not saying that. But also, let me back up and say, the Declaration of Independence is not the Bible. It's a fallible document. You know, it says the best we can, what we can understand about why one people would sever the political relationship they had with another people and so on. And it's a great document, a profound document of incredible significance. I'm not saying any of that's not true. I'm just saying it's okay for us to critique it. It's not scripture. It's just the best we can do. So anyway, this statement, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, tells you that even while we want to acknowledge that rights belong to human beings simply because they're humans, we know that those rights can easily be stripped from human beings if they're not protected by the government to which that human being belongs. And so we said, so to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. And by the way, those governments derive their, and I'm reading from the Declaration of Independence again here, derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. So we're trying to say, but those rights are theirs because of who they are. The governments exist in order to protect those rights, and the people are the ones who give the government the authority that it has to protect those rights. So I think all of that's beautiful. I think it's beautiful. I love the way it's laid out, but it's acknowledging a tension that's always present. because sometimes governments themselves become destructive of these ends, as the Declaration declares. It is the right of the people to alter or to abolish that government and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect the protection of their rights, basically their safety and happiness. That's all fine, but it acknowledges what Hannah Arendt is saying here, or she's acknowledging what it says there, that the reality is we say, oh, well, human beings have inalienable rights. And, you know, we didn't talk about human rights until we were in the wake of World War II. They didn't become human rights until we recognized that we needed something international to stop individual governments from stripping people of their rights. That's when this whole language comes up about human rights and following Nuremberg and all the trials that happened there. And so when she's making this observation, she's not criticizing the idea of human rights. She's saying we should recognize right off the bat how tricky it is for human beings to keep the rights that are theirs because they're human beings, because without legal protection of those rights, you have no protection of them at all. You're a person wandering on a back road and in fear for your life of the bandits that are on the highway. So governments instead are instituted to protect those rights. Now you can say, okay, well, fine, I'll acknowledge that. Okay, well, then let me just say it this way. From that one snippet of this historical statement of what transpired in the mid-20th century, you know, we should always be concerned. We should always be aware of when we start diminishing the rights of human beings in order to protect or advance our rights as citizens. We have to be careful about that. We have to be careful about thinking that we have a right to things that other people don't have a right to simply because their rights are not protected legally. Because at some point, we should be acknowledging that the legal protection needs to come up alongside the human right that we say is inalienable from people. So that's what Hannah Arendt is drawing attention to in this quotation that I gave to you a moment ago. But that's not the danger. The danger comes in the very next paragraph. And here's what she says next. Again, this is in The Origins of Totalitarianism. Hannah Arendt speaking. I'm not Hannah Arendt. Hannah Arendt being quoted by me speaking. Even the terminology, here's what she says, applied to the stateless has deteriorated. So a person's been kicked out of their state or they've left their state. They are now a man without a country, you know, that kind of person. Okay, so even the terminology applied to the stateless has deteriorated. The term stateless at least acknowledged the fact that these persons had lost the protection of their government and required international agreements for safeguarding their legal status. The post-war term, displaced persons, was invented during the war for the express purpose of liquidating statelessness once and for all by ignoring its existence. Non-recognition of statelessness always means repatriation. So, you know, when we called people stateless, and of course this had a lot to do with the Jews during World War II, when we said people were stateless, it meant they needed a new home, they needed somewhere to be. But when you said, oh, well, it's a German Jew who's a vagabond, they've shown up somewhere else, then you wanted to deport them. You wanted to get them back there. Or you wanted to send, or if they were a Polish Jew living in Germany, well, let's send them back to Poland. So you're wanting to repatriate them. So now, my explanation aside, back to Hannah Arendt's statement. So she says, non-recognition of statelessness always means repatriation. That is, deportation to a country of origin, which either refuses to recognize the prospective repatriate as a citizen, or, on the contrary, urgently wants him back for punishment. Either one of those can be the case. That quotation, that idea, is categorizing people, learning to label people in a way that makes them easier for us to deal with. And, you know, I would put it bluntly and say what she's describing historically that happened in Europe during the mid-20th century was categorizing people so that they could be marginalized or expelled rather than be accepted or assimilated. And I'm not talking about Germany right now, although that was the case in Germany as well, but in France and the other nations as well, recategorizing people as displaced persons, finding a different label for them than stateless, so that maybe they're going to become a part of our state. No, saying, oh, no, these people are just refugees. They're coming briefly. They're coming just for a time. Categorizing people so that they can be marginalized or expelled rather than accepted or assimilated was characteristic of that interwar period and then of the Second World War period as well. And obviously that period led to some, you know, some scary things. And I'll pause here to say, I'm not saying that every single time someone is categorized as a displaced person or called a refugee or called an immigrant or whatever they're going to be called, different labels that they're using, that it's automatically going to lead to a Holocaust. I'm not saying that by any stretch of the imagination. But just consider inductive reasoning for a moment. Inductive reasoning, you know, the kind where you say, well, here's an example and there's an example, and so it could happen again, and that might be what's going to happen again. That's what we do with history. We watch what's happened historically over and over again, and we say, wow, well, let's make sure that doesn't happen again. Or, well, let's imitate that so it can happen again. So inductive reasoning isn't faulty reasoning. The thing about inductive reasoning is that it's not foolproof. It's never a guarantee. It's not deductive reasoning. But the point of this is that there's good grounding for drawing the conclusions that we would draw if we say, well, you know, anytime we start categorizing people, and everybody does this, so don't think it doesn't happen all the time, but we can be aware of it and do better. Anytime we start categorizing people for the sake of marginalizing or expelling them, then we should be aware that this could happen. And the grounding for that inductive conclusion lies in the fact that this relationship regarding the marginalized was an enormous change of sociopolitical status for all of those displaced persons, refugees, immigrants, stateless persons, whatever you want to call them, from World War II or from the interwar period before World War II. And it provided real traction for movements among the larger population. That is, when the parties, whether it was the Communist Party or the Fascist Party, and I mean the National Socialist Party, obviously, in Germany, but whatever party it was that was trying to use this, whatever movement it was that was trying to move the masses to follow them, one of the ways they got traction was by targeting a population and recategorizing it. And so, you know, this is part of the reason I think in the Old Testament, and I use Leviticus 19 all the time because the significance of the statement in the middle of it, love your neighbor as yourself, which Jesus gives great significance. But at the end of that chapter in Leviticus 19 is when God says, when a stranger sojourns with you in your land. So these people, the ones who show up and are outsiders, whatever the means is that they show up. And in our world, that means stateless. There were no nation states in the days of Scripture, but it is the same idea. They've left their people. They're coming to live with you. This is what he says about it. When a stranger sojourns with you in your land, you shall not do him wrong. But this is not just an empathetic statement. This is not just be kind to the outsider. This is not that. This is saying that's not how you have a society. When you're going to have a society, everybody in the society follows the same laws. You have to be a part of the same thing. And so this is what he says. When a stranger sojourns with you in your land, you shall not do him wrong. You shall treat the stranger who sojourns with you as the native among you. So if the person who was born among you and lives among you would be punished for a crime, then you punish this person for the same crime. And if they would be rewarded for being a good neighbor, then you should reward this person for being a good neighbor. I mean, you just treat them like a native among you. And you shall love him as yourself, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. And this is why the very next statement is, you shall do no wrong in judgment. This means either to the stranger or to your brother, the neighbor who was born among you. You shall do no wrong in judgment in measures of length or weight or quantity. You shall have just balances, just weights, a just ephah, and so on, just hand. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. So, secondly, this I'll say, you know, historically, I'll put it this way, to give a moral to it. I'm not always going to give a moral to these, but there's one here. We should always be concerned when a group of people is used as fodder to rile up the masses. So, you know, we should just be aware. When we see that happening, we should be the ones who back up and go, wait a minute. These are all people. These are all human beings. So let's just make sure that we're looking at them as human beings before we do anything else. And I mean that about every group. I mean it about every single group. Doesn't matter who it is. Okay. Next example. Let's take this quotation. Here's a statement. This one's in a section on the totalitarian movement. The smaller the movement, Hannah Arendt says, the smaller the movement, the more energy it will expend in mere propaganda, obviously, because you're trying to propagate your cause. The greater, but listen to this, this is interesting. The greater the pressure on totalitarian regimes from the outside world, a pressure that even behind iron curtains cannot be ignored entirely, the more actively will the totalitarian dictators engage in propaganda. Here's the key statement. The essential point is that the necessities for propaganda are always dictated by the outside world, and that the movements themselves do not actually propagate, but indoctrinate. So I know you're not looking at the words on the page to get a process what was said, but what she said was, you know, obviously these movements depend on propaganda, but you think of propaganda as propagation, meaning how do I multiply the movement? How do I win over people who don't agree with me? So I'll put out this brochure and it'll convince the non-believers to believe. You know, it's almost like giving out gospel tracts for people to be converted to whatever the cause is. But her statement is to make the point, make us aware that the reality historically is the opposite of that. That as these movements have developed, what they've used propaganda for is not the propagation of their ideas to people who don't agree with them already, but the indoctrination of their ideas in the people who are already on their side. You should stay with us. You should agree with us. You should realize how important this cause is. And if those people are winning over other people or convincing them or whatever, if it's just strengthening the movement by strengthening those who are in it, what matters in the movement is making sure that the people who agree with you stay in agreement with you. So you toe the line in the things that you say. It's a fairly fascinating observation, which all of us have to be aware of. We do this in churches, we do it in politics, we do it in our families. We always have to be careful that we're not simply, when people use the term echo chamber, I think this is what they have in mind. It's to make the point that we can easily get into a circle where all the people who agree with us are going with us no matter what. And when there's pressure from the outside that seems to put us in a place where they might start disagreeing with us, all we do is start quoting the lines again, going back to the original statements and making sure that everybody's in agreement and winning them over to us again and so on. But, you know, another way to look at this, by the way, is to recognize that movements should concern us if they're defined primarily by what they're against. And that's, you know, that's what this is saying, that when you recognize there's pressure against you, then you rally your resources, you circle the wagons, and you get your ideology established again by using all the red meat lines that you throw out, right? So we all do that again. We all fall into that trap of doing that. And we fall into it with ourselves sometimes as well. And I know, in my own personal historical experience, I know I experienced a lot of defining what I believed in by what I was against in my very early ministry. And I've told you before, I mean, I fell prey to the ideas of a really strict form of legalism. And so it's everything was against. And we joked about it. I mean, we made jokes about ourselves, but they were fond jokes. We were okay with being against everything in the world. And we felt like that's what gave us definition, because it separated us from the people who were in the outside world. We loved that word. It separated us from the people who were out there in the world. And I'm pointing back at movements that are historical, that have had catastrophic consequences in the world. And obviously we're talking mid-20th century genocides, and saying that one of the key characteristics of those movements is that they were defined primarily by what they were against, not what they were for. And this is distinctive. And again, you can read it's a massive book, The Origins of Totalitarianism, to expand on this and to expound on it yourself if you want to. But it is something we should pay attention to. We should be aware that if the key thing we're about is being against something. And you can hear that in the way we've participated in the culture wars now on both sides, that the way we've participated in the culture war has given us a definition, which is about being against those people, what's wrong with those people. And very often I've heard discussions from politicians and from public policymakers and from thinkers, people who ought to be philosophizing, when the subject turned to, well, what do you believe in? It became a very difficult journey to talk about the positive side of what they actually thought, instead of simply what's wrong with the other side. All of us have encountered that. And all of us have run into it in our own lives. Because when you're against something, that's all you can think about. So I just want us to remember that that's a dangerous position to be in. I find it interesting that Hannah Arendt brought it up the way that she did. Next little section is also from the totalitarian movement. And this is on propaganda again. She says, the propaganda effect. This one you can take where you want to take it, and I'll just leave it sitting, right? So the propaganda effect of infallibility. But I am going to say this ahead of time. If you're only hearing this and applying it to one side of the current political world, then you're not paying attention to your own side, because both sides of the political world right now are thoroughly guilty of this, both sides. So here's the statement from Hannah Arendt. And again, she's just describing, and very accurately in a brilliant book from the 1950s. The next edition came out in the 1970s, the one I'm reading. But anyway, it says, the propaganda effect of infallibility, the striking success of posing as a mere interpreting agent of predictable forces, has encouraged in totalitarian dictators the habit of announcing their political intentions in the form of prophecy. So the most famous example is Hitler's announcement to the German Reichstag in January 1939. I want today, this is Hitler, I'm making fun of him. We can make fun of Hitler, we're allowed to do that. I want today, once again, no, I'm not going to make fun of him, I'm just going to read it to you. This is the quotation, though. I want today, once again, to make a prophecy. This is a prophecy from Hitler to the Reichstag. In case the Jewish financiers succeed once more in hurling the peoples into a world war, the result will be the annihilation of the Jewish race in Europe. Now, you hear how he's creating a prophecy. Wow, if we get into another world war and these Jews do what they did before, well, it's going to lead to their annihilation. Of course, the point for it, so she says this, so I'll get back to, let me just quote it from Hannah Arendt. She says, translated into non-totalitarian language, this meant, I intend to make war and I intend to kill the Jews of Europe. But instead, he gave it as a, I'm interpreting the world around me, and it looks to me like this is what's going to happen. Of course, he's the one that's going to do it. So she goes on to say, similarly, Stalin, in the great speech before the Central Committee of the Communist Party in 1930, in which he prepared the physical liquidation of intra-party right and left deviationists, described them as representatives of dying classes. This definition not only gave the argument its specific sharpness, but also announced, in totalitarian style, the physical destruction of those whose dying out had just been prophesied. In both instances, the same objective is accomplished. The liquidation is fitted into a historical process in which man only does or suffers what, according to immutable laws, is bound to happen anyway. Now, I only read you that section to say, you know, if you ever come across that kind of language, and in some really extreme groups right now, you can find that. I've seen groups use this kind of language, but they're way on the fringes of our society, and thank heavens for that. I'm not saying the fringes aren't impinging on the center of our society right now, but the fringes are still fringes, thank heavens. But they will do this. They will make those prophecies. Oh, these people are going to be destroyed, or this structure is going to be destroyed, and wait and see what's going to happen. And then when they do it, they simply say, well, yeah, but I mean, I was just participating in something that was going to happen anyway. You know, it's the ultimate self-fulfilling prophecy. But hear this statement from Hannah Arendt, mid-20th century, writing in the 1950s, after seeing the totalitarian movements develop, Stalin's still standing while she's writing. And this is what she says. Before mass leaders seize the power to fit reality to their lies, their propaganda is marked by its extreme contempt for facts as such. For in their opinion, fact depends entirely on the power of man who can fabricate it. The assertion that the Moscow subway is the only one in the world is a lie only so long as the Bolsheviks have not the power to destroy all the others. In other words, the method of infallible prediction, more than any other totalitarian propaganda device, betrays its ultimate goal of world conquest, since only in a world completely under his control could the totalitarian ruler possibly realize all his lies and make true all of his prophecies. My point in reading this particular quotation to you is simple, just that we have to be concerned And again, I'm telling you, if you're hearing this and only hearing that it applies to one side of the current world or one side of the current political world or one side of the religious world right now, if you only hear it applying to one side, you're not applying it fairly, not applying it, you know, being honest or objective about it. And we just need to look at it and be aware of this. We should always be concerned when there is a disdain for or even just a disrespect for the legitimacy of facts, just the facts that people give. So you can take that for what it's worth, but it is something for us to be aware of right now. All right, next quotation. That's not the next one. That's this one. Okay, next quotation. The effectiveness of this kind of propaganda demonstrates one of the chief characteristics of modern masses. They do not believe anything visible. In the reality, this is, again, Hannah Arendt writing just after the Holocaust, just after World War II, 6 years after it's when it was published, and it's a 500-page book in its short format. I mean short format, meaning published in that way. It could be a lot longer if you wanted it to be. The point is that writing just after World War II, she's just observing what happened, what led to the things becoming what they were in that insane world that she was a part of. And so she says that this is the effectiveness of this kind of propaganda where you're just saying things and asserting that they're the case, and then over time people adopt them as the case. The effectiveness of this kind of propaganda demonstrates one of the chief characteristics of modern masses. They do not believe in anything visible, in the reality of their own experience. They do not trust their eyes and ears, but only their imaginations, which may be caught by anything that is at once universal and consistent in itself. What convinces masses are not facts, and not even invented facts, but only the consistency of the system of which they are presumably part. Repetition, somewhat overrated in importance because the common belief in the masses' inferior capacity to grasp and remember, repetition, is important only because it convinces them of consistency in time. Now, I find this fascinating because I do encounter this sometimes, that leaders are repeating things constantly. And surely, if you just pay attention to the news, you hear this, that people on either side of the political spectrum, they'll take up a phraseology, a way of saying something, and you'll be able to tell that they propagated that, this is what the word propaganda is related to, that they propagated that through all of the channels that they had at their disposal and said, here's how you say it. This is the phrase we're going to use. Here's how we're going to turn it. This is the way we're going to spin it. Whatever word you put on that, surely you've heard from both sides people putting up these phrases that seem to fly in the face of what we actually saw happen. You know, here's what I saw happen. What are you people talking about? This seems exaggerated, or this seems underrated. But they continue to repeat it, and we think to ourselves, well, what kind of fool do they think I am? They just think they're going to say it over and over, and I'm going to come to believe it? No, that's not what it's about. This is what Hannah Arendt is pointing out. Repetition isn't used to break through the muddle-headedness of the masses. That's not the issue. I'm not saying the masses are muddle-headed. I'm saying that would be a mischaracterization of what's going on. The reality is that the repetition is used to create consistency so that you have a system to believe in. Here's a system that works because it coheres. It hangs together, and it's not going to fall apart just because you saw something different over there. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain kind of thing. You just keep saying, no. The great Oz, he is powerful. No, he really is. Watch. You'll see. Over time, you'll see how powerful he is and so on. You get the idea. Commitment to a cause, let me go off on this for just one second. Commitment to a cause above the commitment to truth is a problem. You know, it's something we should be aware of. I'm a Christian because I believe, and I mean as true, as fact, as history, I believe Jesus rose from the dead. I'm not a Christian because of what I think would happen to the world if Christianity were false. I'm not a Christian because I'm afraid society's going to fall apart, or I couldn't justify this educational system we have if we didn't have Christianity, or some other stabilizing factor of the world. I'm not a Christian because of what I want, the results I want. I'm a Christian because I believe Jesus rose from the dead. And since nobody else rose from the dead, I think he's Lord. I think he owns the world and not us. That's why I pursue Christianity, precisely because of its truth. Let me see if I can squeeze in just a few more before we run out of time, and I'll try to be briefer with these and just hit them and move. Here's another quotation. I can't remember what chapter this is from, but anyway, here it is. It's from page 353 in the book. The most efficient fiction of Nazi propaganda was the story of a Jewish world conspiracy. Concentration on anti-Semitic propaganda had been a common device of demagogues ever since the end of the 19th century and was widespread in the Germany and Austria of the 20s, and she goes on to discuss it and how it developed in Nazi Germany and all that kind of stuff. But the point is that any time, and I'll go back, and I could have used this as more evidence of what I was saying earlier, that we should be aware of how easy it is for us to use populations, for us to use people who can be identified distinctly from us as tools for motivating us, as tools for getting us to care passionately about something. And you can do that well, and you can do it poorly. I mean, you can do it, obviously, to provoke empathy and concern, but you can also do it to create a lot of disdain and separation. And again, it happens worldwide. It happens everywhere. That shouldn't make us say, oh, well, then it's okay. What it should make us say is, oh, yeah, I'm going to be aware of that. I'm always going to pay attention to that, that if people are using other people to create some way of segregating us from them. Okay, another one, another quotation, just a couple of paragraphs below that one. In another curious and roundabout way, however, the Nazis gave a propaganda answer to the question of what their future role would be, and that was in their use of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. I don't know if you've heard of this work or not, so I'm going to pause. I'm not quoting Hannah right now. I'm telling you this. So the Protocols of the Elders of Zion is this pamphlet type book work that came out early 20th century, maybe super late 19th century. And it was a description of a secret cabal of Jewish leaders who ran the world and had been running it for centuries. And they had these protocols that were, this book was supposed to be somebody having found the book that they used to govern their secret society, to give them the rules and tools for how they could rule the world secretly with nobody ever finding out about it. Okay, that's the idea. And it's a total fraud, total fraud. Everybody knows it's a fraud, completely manufactured work. But it was published by the Bukus in the early 20th century and became one of the fundamental tools of anti-Semitism all the way through World War II. And so that work is what she's referring to. And what she says is, and this is really, it's really ironic how the Nazis used this, because they used it as a way of saying, oh, those wicked, you know, Jews are trying to take over the world, while at the same time saying, and wow, their tool worked for centuries, so we're going to use it. And that's going to become the guideline for how we rule the world as Nazis. So this is the idea of this paragraph. So we hear what she says. In another curious and roundabout way, however, the Nazis gave a propaganda answer to the question of what their future role would be, and that was in their use of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion as a model for the future organization of the German masses for the world empire. The use of the protocols was not restricted to the Nazis. Hundreds of thousands of copies were sold in post-war Germany, and this is post-World War I, Germany, and even their open adoption as a handbook of politics was not new. Nevertheless, this forgery was mainly used for the purpose of denouncing the Jews and arousing the mob to the dangers of Jewish domination. In terms of mere propaganda, the discovery of the Nazis was that the masses were not so frightened by Jewish world rule as they were interested in how it could be done, that the popularity of the protocols was based on admiration and eagerness to learn rather than on hatred, and that it would be wise to stay as close as possible to certain of their outstanding formulas, as in the case of the famous slogan, this is part of the protocols, but this is translated into the Nazi form, right is what is good for the German people, which was copied from the protocols, this quotation, everything that benefits the Jewish people is morally right and sacred. Okay, so I'm reading that little section to you to say, you know, first of all, on the conspiracy side, you know, if the things that you're watching and listening to and the things you pay attention to, the things that govern the way you see the world involve secret conspiracies of people who are ruling the world or governing things behind the scenes and so on like that, this statement doesn't mean there are no people who conspire to do evil things. Of course there are. But the idea that there's a cabal running the world or something like that should give you pause, because historically, that tool of convincing people that there's a secret, powerful organization or people group who who are ruling the world from behind the stage, is used both to alienate that people group so that you can do what we were describing before, and then secondly, to actually give a tool and an encouragement to the people who are criticizing the cabal to say, you know, we should take over that ruling of the world. We're the ones who should do that. That's what's happened historically. I'm not saying it's happening now. I don't know whether it is or not. But I will say to you, anytime that we start noticing this prevalence of conspiracy and conspiratorial thinking, conspiracy thinking, we should back up and go, yeah, that's not kind of good history. I'm pretty sure I don't want to go there. Let me give you another quotation before we run out of time here. The true goal of totalitarian propaganda is not persuasion, but organization. So I'm going to read you this one and then one more, and then we'll be done. The accumulation of power without the possession of the means of violence. So the true goal of totalitarian propaganda is not persuasion, but organization. That is, organization, the accumulation of power without the possession of the means of violence. Originality in ideological content can only be considered an unnecessary obstacle. It is no accident that the two totalitarian movements of our time, Nazi Germany, obviously, the Soviet Union, so frightfully new in methods of rule and ingenious in forms of organization, have never preached a new doctrine, have never invented an ideology which was not already popular. Not the passing successes of demagogy win the masses, but the visible reality and power of a living organization. It's all about the organization and the structure that goes with that organization and so on. I wish I could read more of that to you, but that's important to this last quotation I want to give you. And I'm going to skip a bunch of quotations to get to this one to make this point. Because by the time she goes through this whole discussion leading up to total domination and what totalitarianism, how it finally became what it was under Hitler briefly, but under Stalin for a much longer time and in the Soviet Union, as she leads up to that discussion, she comes to this conclusion about why people are so willing to participate in this over time, why there's never enough palace intrigue to overthrow. You know, why wasn't somebody inside Hitler's inner circle able to kill him? They wanted to. Why was there never a palace overthrow in Stalin's regime? There were plenty of people who wanted to overthrow him. There were people who had the entire military behind them, but they never overthrew him. What was going on? And so she makes the point through a long argument with a lot of different elements about why that is brilliant, by the way. Please go read the book, The Origins of Totalitarianism, when you get the opportunity, if you can stand a huge book about sociological political science, and you should. Anyway, the point is, this is the last quote I'll read to you. She says, although we have enough reports from concentration camps, which are a part of the tools of totalitarian regimes, although we have enough reports from concentration camps to assess the possibilities of total domination and to catch a glimpse into the abyss of the possible, we do not know the extent of character transformation under a totalitarian regime. We know even less, and this is a really important part of what it takes for a regime to become totalitarian, and this is scary. We know even less how many of the normal people around us would be willing to accept the totalitarian way of life. And what does that mean, to accept the totalitarian way of life? This is it, after an M-dash, she says. That is, to pay the price of a considerably shorter life for the assured fulfillment of all their career dreams. So that statement, which is built into the middle of, you know, sort of developing an understanding of why people would be a part of a regime like this over time, it's not sheer force. It's also convincing people that it's worthwhile being a part of, this is a better choice than going the other direction. And these are populations of hundreds of millions of people that we're talking about. And that idea invites this consideration that at the core of it, it's just because most of us as human beings would say, yeah, I'll give a pass to them on that genocide. I'll give a pass to them on this slaughter of individuals over there. I'll give a pass to them. I'm not saying we have done that. I'm saying we are inclined to be the kind of people that she's mentioning here in this sort of terrifyingly banal passage, which is an appropriate term to use in a Hannah Arendt book. She, you know, what she's saying is, yeah, most people would say, yeah, I can overlook all of that because my career is benefiting. I'm moving up. Look, I'm going to be the person in power. I'm going to be the person who can make a difference. And I'm going to do the right thing, of course, when I get there. briefly before I'm replaced by the next person who's going to take my spot, but is willing to do it because their career is advancing as well. That's kind of a scary image of what it takes to develop a totalitarian regime. And yet, you know, here we are. There's so much more that I would love to read to you out of this. And I guess my motivation for doing this is twofold. You know, at the very top level, I'm simply saying, man, you got to read some Hannah Arendt. She's just so insightful. I just encourage you to get a book, an article, find something online. There's plenty of material online that you could read from Hannah Arendt and just see some of the stuff that she described, because her descriptions become prescriptive as they work their way into us. That's number one. But the second reason is, you know, sort of moralistic. It has to do with the way we need to understand history. And even if we can't do it in a 40-minute, you know, episode, we can at least invite the consideration. I share these historical events with the knowledge that history repeats itself. You know that. And here's the thing I want to close with. Why does history repeat itself? Well, you know, number one, because the passing of generations doesn't mean the death of human nature. So people over time, with all of their differences, are still people. So, and that means that the way people behave continues to be the way people behave. As much as we'd like to think that human nature changes over time, and a lot of things about it do, we have lots of differences over time, but people are still people. Second, the crossing of an ocean. So I was just saying the passing of time, right? So now think more about things that happen synchronously, you know, with people who live at the same time. The crossing of an ocean, or the amalgamation of wealth, or the rise of technology does not make one people less vulnerable to the patterns described in the readings that I was doing earlier than any other people. It doesn't matter whether you have a cell phone or don't have a cell phone. We're still just as vulnerable to, and vulnerable meaning as likely to be led into it, as suggestible, as inclined as a people to fall prey to these things if they're bad, or to rise to them if they're good. We are similar people, and so history repeats itself. And then finally, because history repeats itself, because the greatest problems and the greatest solutions in history neither begin nor culminate in great leaders. Totalitarianism didn't happen because of Stalin or Hitler. It's not a great leader's issue. The greatest problems and the greatest solutions in history don't begin and don't culminate in those great leaders, but in the persons whose values and choices ultimately determine whether we want to follow those leaders. That's us, not them. So may we trust God and value others the way He teaches us to do.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.